But that's probably an interesting place to start, because when I looked at the cover of this book, The War in the Country, and saw cows on the cover and a planted field, yeah. I thought, oh, this is another one of these food books, Michael Pollan, or even, you know, Thomas mm-hmm. Pollock, your own book, The End of Food.
Yeah.
But then when I got into it, it was nothing like that at all. It was nothing that I expected. It turned into a fisticuffs tabloid version of a huge dysfunctional rural family. Literally. I mean,
you got it right. You got it figured out. I'm glad.
No one.
That was the message I was trying to get across.
The title is exactly bang on. It sounds like a real battle out there in the country. And the book seems to divide up quite cleanly between villains and, I would say, victims. And each or many of the chapters discuss some of these scenarios or skirmishes. Maybe they're a bit bigger than skirmishes. And I thought maybe you could start us off with telling us the story of Mark Slack and his dream to start a hog farm. Why did he wind up in this book as a combatant? What happened there?
Well, he's kind of a typical example of a generation of country people whose parents were just, you know, pinned to the wall by their position in the economy, which was at the bottom of the heap. And the children, the few that stayed in farming, most children of the last generation of farmers concluded by watching their parents that this was a mug's game and they were not going to get into it. And even when their parents said, look, we'll give you the family farm, they'd say, I don't want it. It's like giving me, smallpox. And they would just go to the city and get a job and never come back to the farm. And a certain small percentage of those people decided to stay on the farm anyway. And Mark Slack was one of them. His parents were farmers, and he grew up on a farm. He went to the University of Guelph and got a degree in agriculture. So his whole orientation was towards the farm. But then he took a look at, you know, the economics of the industry now and the way it's been set up, and he realized that he could not function the way his parents functioned and expect to make a living. And he bought what the extension agents and the government representatives were selling a few years back, and they were saying industrial agriculture is the way to go. If you want to survive and stay on the land, you have to become an intensive livestock operator or somebody who is involved somehow in industrial agriculture. And Slack said, okay, if that's the cost, if that's the price for staying on the land, I'll pay it. And he went for it. And I don't think he really gave any thought, at least not very much thought, to the consequences of that decision to the environment and to his neighbors. I think he was just looking for a way to survive and stay in the country.
And he went, the way you describe it, he went sort of shopping around the countryside up in your area, looking for a place that he could set up a fairly large-scale hog farm, and yet he ran into opposition at every step of the way.
Yeah, everywhere he went, people got up in arms, and with good reason, because, there was a core group. The first place he started was in a little town called Aaronsville, and he started out there, and it just so happened that a number of the people that lived in that area were aware of the factory farm phenomenon and knew what it was all about. And this core group saw his proposal and thought, uh-oh, we don't want this here. And then they went around and alerted their neighbors. And, of course, after the first group, got in full swing and stopped him, then he went to other places, and other places had heard about the controversy with the first group. So it was like the snowball kept going down the hill, and everywhere he went, he met opposition. So that was kind of the way it developed. And he, I don't think at the start, really understood what the stakes were. I mean, for others. He understood what the stakes were for him. He was hoping to make a decent living and stay in the country, and this seemed to offer the chance to do that. But I don't think he ever gave a second thought to what it might do to the environment or to his neighbors.
Give us a thumbnail.
And when they started to complain.
Thomas, give me a thumbnail sketch of what is that impact for us city dwellers? What is that impact on neighbors? For instance, what are these manure rules, basically, of how people can deal with the manure that's generated by one of these operations? We'll just tick off some of the downsides of this type of industrial hog operation.
Yeah, well, the first thing is the sheer amount of manure that's produced. And people in the cities don't realize it, but an intensive hog farm is like a medium-sized human town. You know, you go riding around the countryside in Ontario, and you see signs like population 1,000 or population 2,000 for a town. And a pig, an adult pig, it produces more manure than an adult human. And if you have 2,000 or 3,000 or in some cases 10,000 adult hogs on a farm, you've got the equivalent of 10,000 people crowded into a bunch of maybe four big barns or four big apartment houses. A good comparison would be to take a high-rise apartment building and say, you know, if you put 10,000 people on 100 or 200 acres in a few high-rise buildings, you know, what kind of sewer system would you need to service that village? And you'd need quite a sizable sewer system to, you know, avoid serious pollution and cholera and everything else, you know. But what people don't realize is that a hog farm is like that. And instead of installing a big, huge sewer system, what they do is they just take the shit and they spread it on the fields, spray it out with a manure sprayer. And they do this over and over again. And they try to get contracts with neighbors to spread manure on their land. Because there is a provincial law that says you can only spread so much manure on so many acres, and it limits you. And if you don't have a big farm, if you've only got a couple hundred acres, where in hell are you going to spread all that manure?
I'm going to come at you like an ignorant urbanite here,
yeah.
But so basically it goes from being a good fertilizer to being basically just sheer pollution in too big a quantity.
Yeah, it's because it's concentrated in a small spot. Now, if you had the same number of hogs scattered on, you know, 40 different farms spread over a geographical area like it used to be as late as the 1950s, then it wouldn't be a problem because the pollution wouldn't be concentrated so heavily in one spot. It would be spread out over, you know, God knows how many square kilometers. And so you don't need an intense sewer system to handle it. But the problem is when, and the ILO, Intensive Livestock Operation, the problem is it is just that. It is intensive. And it's so intensive in such a small a geographical area that it creates this huge pollution problem. And essentially, a farmer, an industrial farmer, should have a sewer system equivalent to that of a medium-sized village, human village, in order to adequately dispose of it. But of course, who can afford that, you know? So what they do is they use these other methods which don't really adequately dispose of the manure. And the provincial laws, which are written to govern this, are not strict enough. And on top of that, what makes it even worse is that after a considerable amount of lobbying by industrial farm interests, the provincial governments in most of Canada and most of the state governments in the U.S. made it a secret, made it confidential how much manure a farm was actually producing and spreading on a given acreage.
Why would they make it confidential? Why would they make it confidential?
Because the farmers don't want anybody to know, essentially, how much drug they are spreading and how little land they're spreading it on, because if people know, people will get upset and frightened. So the governments came along and said, oh, you know, Swiss Premium or whoever, you know, some big meat packer, and he's got all these, intensive operations under contract to them, they come to us and say, look, make this a secret so people don't know. And being good little politicians whose campaign funds are, you know, dependent on what the corporations give them, they say, yes, a boss, and they do it. And right now, if I had a hog farm move in next to me, which so far I haven't had, and I wanted to know how much manure he was spreading, it's a secret. It's illegal for me to find out. And if I found out and reported it in a newspaper article, I could be sued and prosecuted by the government. So, you know, this is like a state secret, you know, atomic weapons or, you know, chasing the Al-Qaeda around Canada. Well, our factory farm pollution is in the same category. It's as closely guarded a state secret as who was suspected of being a member of a terrorist group.
There's a lot of things in this book which will leave people, readers, just shaking their heads at how ridiculous some of the steps seem. But Mark Slack, I mean, eventually he jumped around from Young's Road in Stone's Mill down to another area, Tandiaga, down back to Stone Mills, over to Tweed. Finally, after shopping around, he seems to getting refused and rebuffed at every turn.
Yeah.
He got a toehold in one place, and it seems like he actually got to build his plant, if you will, invest about $2 million
in it. He built his first plant. And his first plant, he had intended to build several on the same property. He built one, and of course there was heavy opposition to that. But what happened was the local Reeve...
Heavy opposition, that's a bit of an understatement. In your book, you talk about vandalism, trucks being run off the road, some really nasty...
shot at his tractor. A guy went over and filled his tractor full of bullet holes. So, I mean, it was really pretty hot and heavy. And you know, I'm against, personally, I'm against the industrial farm idea and would have been opposed to Slack. But at the same time, I had a great deal of sympathy for the guy because I don't think he really realized what he was getting himself into when he went into this. And I think he was in over his head at a certain point. You know, socially and legally, and just didn't realize it was going to cause all this trouble. But he was stubborn as hell, and what got him to succeed was that the local municipal government in the previous places had gone against him. But in the Tweed area, a fellow ran and became Reeve of that municipality, who was an intensive livestock operator himself. He owned a very large poultry farm, and he sided with Slack pretty much. He claims that he was being fair, and Slack claims that he was being fair. And in my book, I you know, quote them both as saying that, so they have their chance to, you know, give their side of the story. But their opponents thought, and there was quite a bit of evidence behind it, that the new Reeve favored Slack because he himself was an intensive livestock operator. And he helped kind of politically push the thing through in Tweed. And so Slack finally got what he wanted. And he built his first barn.
Now, another fellow who did not have maybe quite as happy an ending is... In just the next chapter, in fact, it's the story of another dreamer, this fellow Sean Carmichael. And he built up a batch from high school days, a hobby batch of 500 chickens, if I've got it right, to an operation of 15,000 chickens.
Yeah.
And in the book, you describe an almost surreal scene of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency descending on the farm like a SWAT team with... You say sidearms and...
Well, it was a SWAT team of the Ontario Provincial Police.
So tell us, what did Carmichael do to bring such wrath upon himself and his family?
Well, he went against the marketing board. See, there's a marketing board that decides, you know, that if you raise poultry or either for meat birds or you raise poultry for eggs, you have to become part of one of the marketing boards and sell your product through the board. It's part of the marketing board system, which I generally support, you know, as an idea, as a theory. I support it, but in practice, it's become corrupted. And he was, he didn't have enough quota. And he wanted to raise birds and sell them, but in order to do so under the marketing board regulations, he would have had to buy a quota, and he would have had to have millions of dollars to buy sufficient quota. There's a ceiling. The marketing board at the time he was involved allowed you to raise a maximum of 500 birds without buying quota. And up to the point where he had 500, he was still legal and didn't have to buy any quota. But then he decided to go beyond that and test the waters and see if, you know, how hard they would come down on him. Because his operation, even at its peak, was considered small potatoes by the marketing board.
15,000 chickens is small potatoes?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was considered like a minor little operator, and he figured, well, I'm so small with only 15,000 birds that they won't care if I have quota or not. And he was kind of counting on that, but he didn't, he was mistaken. The board said, look, we don't want you to do this because it'll be a bad example, and everybody will be trying to farm without quota, and then we won't have any control anymore, so we're going to go after you.
What's wrong with that argument, though? What if everyone went the Sean Carmichael route and slipped in under the radar? Would that not blow the marketing board system up?
It would. It would destroy the marketing board system.
Which
in a way would be a bad thing, and in a way would be a good thing, and that's the complexity of the marketing board system, and the difficulty of it is that it is basically a good idea, but in practice it's been corrupted and has become a bad idea because of the way it's been conducted, and that's a bit complicated. I have to explain that usually to people. And what happened was when marketing boards were first instituted in Canada just after the Second World War, well, they were first instituted after the First World War, but then they were abandoned, and then they were brought back again after the Second World War, to get quota. Quota means you're allowed to produce so much of an agricultural commodity. You have a quota that you can produce legally, and then you turn it over to the board, and they market it for you. You can't exceed your quota and still market it through the board. So when they started out, quota was set by what your capacity of production was. If you had a farm that could produce, that could house and get the milk from 100 dairy cattle, you were assigned 100 cattle quota. You were just assigned it, and it didn't cost you anything. The board just gave it to you. So whatever your production capacity was, that was the quota that you were given by the board. And it didn't cost you anything, and so you didn't have to pay any premium to enter, you know, to enter that industry. But after a few years, people began to realize, well, this quota that I have, and I have a legal right to produce so much milk every year, this is kind of like a license to operate. It's like having a, you know, a restaurant license or something, and this is worth something. And if I decide to retire from farming or go into another line of work, I should be able to sell this and get some money for it, because it's a desirable entity. And people began to think like that, and privately, in private agreements, they were starting to buy and sell their quota. And the marketing boards would come in and say, you can't sell quota. Quota is free, you know. But they kept doing it anyway. And then they began to sue the marketing board to get the right to buy and sell quota. And the marketing boards went through a whole big pile of lawsuits and spent a lot of money. And finally, they just said, oh, the hell with it. All of our members want to be able to buy and sell quota, and we can't hold this back. It's the wave of the future. And so they said, okay, we'll make it legal to buy and sell quota. And when they did that, they destroyed the marketing board system. They destroyed themselves. They were suicidal.
And you say, you remind us that selling quota means it's making it very expensive for a young person to get into this business. Too expensive.
Yeah, because what happened was they began to bid up the price. And the price would go up and up and up. And gradually it got so only a very large operator with a lot of money, or a large operator with a contract with a big corporation that had a lot of money, could afford to buy quota, because you would need anywhere from $1.5 to $7 million to start a dairy farm just to buy the quota. And never mind buying the land and the barn and the farm equipment and the herd of cattle, which would be in addition to that. So what happened was the marketing boards, instead of being a way to rescue farmers from the cost-price squeeze, it became an additional factor in the cost-price squeeze and made it worse. And it made it almost impossible for a young person to start in farming. And that's the way it is now. The quota industries in Canada right now, the only way you can become a dairy farmer or, you know, a big hog farmer or something is if you have millions of dollars to invest at the start. And, you know, most young people graduating from Guelph University don't have millions of dollars. So the only way they can get it is if they inherit it from a parent or if they get the money for it from a large corporation, which says, okay, we'll hire you as a farm manager, and we'll buy the quota. And that's the way it goes now. So you have these big, large operations, which cost millions of dollars to launch, and now they dominate the marketing boards. And so all the decisions made by the marketing boards more or less go along with what these very large, very wealthy groups or individuals want in terms of policy. And they go to the government and they go to their own meetings, the board meetings, and they set policy. And that policy becomes more and more exclusive and more favorable to the large players and less favorable to the small ones, to the point where, in some cases, there's not any point in a person even thinking about going into farming. It's just been made impossible. And the only people who can do it are large institutional investors or very rich individuals.
Let me just reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Thomas Pollock, the author of The War in the Country, How the Fight to Save Rural Life Will Shape Our Future. Now, Thomas, we shouldn't leave our listeners hanging. Can you take us back to Sean Carmichael and tell us how this all wrapped up? In the book, it's almost farcical, but awfully sad. The CFIA only brought a truck that could handle half of Sean Carmichael's chickens when they wanted to haul them all away. So what happened next?
Well, first of all, the police came in and they forced their way into his house with weapons drawn. And carrying automatic weapons and wearing flak jackets and black hoods and all that. And his little boy, who I think he was 5 years old or something at the time, was in his bedroom, and a couple of flak jacketed, black hooded police officers with automatic weapons forced open his bedroom door and came in pointing their guns at him. And the kid was so freaked that he to this day, can't stay in a room with all the doors closed, because he is afraid that a bunch of men in black will come bursting through the door pointing guns at him. So, I mean, this kid was traumatized, you know? And they just acted like idiots. And, I mean, why did they need a SWAT team, you know, for this farmer and his family? That's crazy. And so they came in and they said, well, you know, these birds are illegal and we're taking them all away. And we can't fit them in a truck. Well, we'll force them into the truck. So they just began cramming them in there. It was just, I know a couple of people who were present at the time and watched it. And they said it was just stupid. It was like these people had no brain, you know. And, of course, a large number of the birds died. They just either were smothered or had their necks broken or were crushed, you know, by the cops pushing them in into this truck. And so Carmichael knew about an organization in Ontario called the Ontario Landowners Association. And this is a citizens group, an activist citizens group, which I think is probably the only one out there who is effectively fighting against this stuff. And what they do is when somebody is being attacked by government or by inspectors or by whoever, and they put out a call to the landowners come to the scene, and they physically interpose themselves between the cops and the victim. And so Carmichael called up the landowners, and a fellow who is now a member of provincial parliament, and Randy, I can't think of his last name for some reason, Randy Hillier, who is now an MPP in Queen's Park, and his friends descended on the Carmichael farm in trucks, pickup trucks and tractors and so forth. They surrounded the farm and surrounded the police. And Carmichael himself got on his tractor and rode it out and blocked the laneway so that the police could not physically leave his property. And there the police were surrounded on all sides by these people who wouldn't let them move.
Well, you laugh, so, but it sounds like it could have turned ugly if you've got sidearms.
It could have turned very ugly because a lot of the farmers who came to stop this had shotguns in their pickup trucks, you know. And God help any cop that would have shot at them. I wasn't there, but I know the temper of people. And if a cop had taken a pot shot at one of these people, he probably would have been riddled. And so the cops realized that it was a pretty tense situation. And to the credit of whoever was in command of that group, he said, look, this is going to degenerate into violence unless we leave. And we're leaving. And so the cops just left. But it didn't do Carmichael much good because half of his birds were dead. And nobody was going to compensate him for that. I mean, he lost thousands and thousands of dollars in dead livestock that day. And, of course, the birds lost their lives. And it was just a terrible thing. So, and then, of course, they took him to court and they prosecuted him for this and that and the other thing. And in the end, it cost him so much to defend himself. It's at least $100,000 and probably more than that, defending himself against all the various legal and other attacks. And finally, it just got to be too damned expensive. And he says, I can't afford to stay in business. So he just said to hell with it. And the birds that were left alive, he sold them and he got out of business, went out of that business. So they succeeded in driving him out, even though in the long run, the legal cases against him all fell apart, and he actually won in court the right to raise his birds, but by that time he had already given up and gotten rid of his operation. So he was driven out of business.
Now, we cannot, unfortunately, people should buy the book and read it, but we can't walk our listeners through each of the great stories you tell in this book, but I can just say that city dweller like me, who thought that the country was just a bucolic, peaceful place, this book is chock-a-block full of incidents and victims and villains, and nobody is spared. You recount the tale of windmill sausages in Trenton, which is suddenly hit with industrial-scale hygiene requirements, and a vegetarian restaurant.
At the same time that Maple Leaf Mills in Toronto was not being hit with those requirements, and as a result, 22 people died. So there's a double standard. The province goes after the small butcher shops and the small abattoirs, but they leave the big ones, the big industrial ones, they hardly touch them. And, the 22 people that died didn't die from, the Windmill Sausage Company. They died from Maple Leaf Mills. The big corporate entity is the one that was at fault. But what's happening now, and this is the main point I want people to take away from the book, is that there are groups that have formed which have just said, this is enough. We've had enough of this stuff. This is ridiculous, and we're just going to stop this. And the groups were originally formed in the country and were originally made up of country people, but increasingly they're gaining urban supporters and urban members. And every time I talk about this, I urge people who live in the cities to join these groups and support them, because once the politicians see that urban people are getting on board and saying, look, this industrial system does not work, we don't want it, and we're tired of watching you persecute the family farmers, stop this, rewrite your rules, let's go back and make something a little bit more human out of this. When the majority of people in the cities start to do this, then the politicians are going to turn around and say, okay, maybe the corporations want us to do it, and maybe they're supplying our campaign funds for our election campaign, but if we do it, we won't get elected at all. We'll just be booted right out. So we're going to just have to change our way of doing things. And that will happen if the people in the cities join these groups and start to fight.
Which brings me to probably the most my most important question is, you say that 80% of our population lives in cities.
Yeah.
Why, besides this being an eye-opening read and interesting and entertaining, why should I, as an urban dweller, care? Why do I care about these rural dust-ups in the Tweed area?
Well, I can tell you that very quickly. First of all, you should care if you eat, because the quality of the food produced by the industrial food system is steadily deteriorating and has been doing so for 50 years or more. The nutrient content of supermarket food has dropped so remarkably in the last 50 years that anybody who is familiar with the figures finds themselves incredulous. It's just unbelievable. And the book I wrote previous to The War in the Country, The End of Food, talks about that and cites figures. For example, the average tomato today has 22.7% less protein than a tomato that would have been sold in 1963 when John Kennedy was shot. It also has 31% less vitamin A, 17% less vitamin C, 61.5% less calcium, and you can go down the list. Every single nutrient is falling by just astounding amounts, like 61.5% less calcium in a tomato than in 1963. I mean, everything is being lost. We're losing the vitamins, we're losing the minerals, we're losing the enzymes, and the result is the food we have is becoming, in order to get the same nutrient value that our grandparents or even our parents got in 1950 or in 1960, we'd have to eat four times as much food, the same foods, because we're just not getting the nutrients anymore. And on top of that, not only are we not getting the nutrients, but as everyone knows, nature abhors a vacuum, we are getting things instead of the nutrients, like acrylamides, nitrates, which are metabolized in the human body into nitrites, which are carcinogenic, heavy metals, dioxin, bovine growth hormone, bromates. There's a witch's brew of contaminants that are showing up in our food. And at one point, a group of nutritionists did a study of members of parliament in Ottawa, and they found 150 inorganic chemicals, most of which were toxic, in the blood of the ordinary parliamentarian. So at one point we have a graph line going downward, and it's the drop in nutrients. We're losing nutrients. And the other line on the graph is going upward, and that's the increase in contaminants. And at a certain point, those two trend lines are going to intersect and make an X. And the point where they intersect, I call it the end of food, because at that point, your food is going to be so low in nutrients that and so full of toxic contaminants that you'd be better off eating plaster of Paris. Because even though plaster of Paris contains no nutrients, at least it doesn't have the poisons in it. So people would be better off eating plaster of Paris at that point. And I'm just projecting it mathematically on a graph, following the trend lines that have been there for the past 50 years, we would reach this point in about 10 years. So should people in the city care about that? Well, yeah.
I think we should we should also hurry to the bookstore and get end of food because time is running out.
Yes. And on top of that, the effect on the environment of industrial farms is very bad and very severe. The water pollution, air pollution, and soil erosion produced by the factory farm operations are just awful. And if anybody looks that up in the war in the country, they'll see that it's one of the major, in fact, on-farm pollution was identified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as the single greatest source of water pollution was from farming, and most of it from industrial farms. So our environment is being destroyed, the quality of our food is being destroyed, and if you live in a city, that means the quality of your food and your environment is being destroyed. And at the same time, and possibly most important, the people in the country who know how to farm ecologically, who know the principles of organic farming, and who know how to operate a small, non-industrial farm, are being driven out of business, and their children aren't going into farming. So 10 or 15 years from now, who is going to be left who knows how to farm? Nobody.
Thomas Pollack, you've made a compelling case for why we all should care and why we all should read the book. However, I'm a bit surprised that it takes your book to bring most of these stories to the fore. I, for instance, went back and tried to research a little bit on some of these stories, but I came up with a big zero on searching for Ardagh Algonquins or Frontenac Ventures, who were involved in a uranium prospecting battle. And I found no information, no articles in the Globe and Mail, no articles in the Toronto Star, nothing if you don't go down to the local newspaper, the Whig Standard. Yeah. And this is a bit of a softball question because it comes back to another of your books, which was entitled The Invisible Farm, The Worldwide Decline of Farm News and Agricultural Journalism Training. Why are these stories not better reported?
Well, because the population, the rural population and the farm population has fallen to the point where it's barely 2% of Canada's people are rural dwellers. And so there's only 2% of the people living on farms. Most newspapers and TV stations are geared where their advertisers figure the demographic is. We can get the bang for our advertising buck. And the rural areas just don't figure in that at all. So a big city newspaper like, the Globe and Mail or any of the big city newspapers, the Montreal Gazette or whatever, they figure, okay, our subscribers, our readers are all urban people. And they're the ones who are going to buy things that our advertisers have to sell. So we're geared towards an urban audience. And the next conclusion is, to them it seems logical, they don't care about things going on in rural areas, so we just don't report on the rural areas anymore. And this seems logical on the surface, but then you think, do most urban readers eat? Or do they breathe or drink water? Well, yes, they do. And then if that's the case, then what happens in the rural areas should matter to them because it's affecting their food, their air, and their water. But the newspapers don't and the television stations don't think that far through, on the question.
Now, Thomas Pollack, I want to ask you about the sort of the angle or the slant of this book, and I don't mean any offense, but it struck me that it was somewhat one-sided. The good guys and the bad guys were always very clear-cut, it seemed to me. There wasn't a whole lot of room for any of the groups who are cast as villains, and that includes corporations and financial people, and particularly the government. They didn't seem to get a lot of airtime to express their side of the story, if there is one. Yeah. Is there a need for balance, or is this just so clear-cut that there's no point in being balanced?
If nobody else is telling that side of the story, and everybody else is either ignoring the story entirely or telling the story in a way favorable to the industrial system, then the one lone isolated voice out there that is standing up and saying, no, that's not the way it is, you have to shout to be heard. And essentially what I was doing in the book was shouting like hell to get somebody to pay attention. And you don't do that by being balanced.
And if I called up the government agencies depicted in the book, what kind of reaction would I get?
You would find that everything I said was true, and there were no factual errors because maybe some minor error, but basically everything in my books is true. It's just I'm not giving in the book a lot of air space or sentences to the factory farm people to defend themselves. And largely because when they do defend themselves, they get these weird arguments. I'll give you an example. I was on a radio program, and we had a veterinarian who was a veterinarian who took care of factory farms, specifically poultry farms, was defending the factory farm method. And he was using arguments that the average city listener would probably find logical. He said, for example, well, we keep hens in our battery system in these small cages, and we might keep seven or eight hens in this tiny little cage. But if you go out to the free-range operations, to the fields and orchards where the chickens are running around in the grass, you'll note that there's eight or ten chickens in the flock that are all clumped together, and they're running around the orchard all together in a clump. So since they're all flocked together anyway, what's the difference? We put them in a cage, and they're clumped together like they are in nature, he says. And the reply I would give to that, although I didn't think of it at the time, was, yes, if you go to the average hockey rink and you notice where the puck is, there's a big clump of players all around that puck, and they might be clumped up in an area 10 by 10 foot. So our hockey rinks need only be 10 by 10 feet, right? Oh, our kids should play hockey in a 10 by 10 foot hockey rink. I mean, that was the kind of logic that was being applied there. And what happens is you start to listen to the industrial farm defenders, and they give you stuff like this. And all it does is confuse people and usually confuse them with a bunch of BS, you know? So I figured, okay, I'm not going to waste pages in my book with that stuff. I'm going to give them the truth, period, and there it is. And if they want to go and talk to the industrial farmers, well, they can go and talk to them, and they're easy to find because they have huge publicity machines. They, you know, the corporations that run these things, they might have a whole public relations department with a staff of 100, you know, and they have advertising agencies pushing their products, and the government is in favor of them, and the few papers that do report on it report from their standpoint, because that's the only voice they ever hear. So there I am, one guy, you know. So I put it all in one spot.
And, Thomas, you end the book with 15 rather commonsensical recommendations for steps that could be taken, that should be taken, to try and redress the problems. I'm going to encourage people to simply buy the book and read them themselves. One is, I guess the first one is to get informed. But how optimistic are you? None of these seem to be slam dunks that they could be done overnight. How optimistic are you?
Oh, no, it's going to take a considerable amount of work. But the best way to do it is through organization. And since there are already organizations in existence, I would urge readers or listeners or viewers or whatever in the cities to go and the two organizations that I promote here, one is the National Farmers Union, the NFU, They have an associate member category where you don't have to be a farmer to join the National Farmers Union. You can be an associate member, and that means that you support their views and you support their political stance, and you support them with dues, which help them finance their lobbying efforts and their research efforts. And it's the same with the other group that I mentioned, the Landowners Association. The landowners have a category of membership where you don't actually have to own land or be a farmer. But if you're sympathetic to their views, you can join and help support them. And I know darn well that if a significant number of city dwellers join these two organizations and start to support them in terms of political pressure on government, the whole thing would change very quickly. In 5 years, we could turn it around.
Thomas Pollock, thank you very much for your time. Thomas Pollock's book is entitled The War in the Country. And Thomas, thank you for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.